In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
From flooding in the Northeast to rebuilding in the midst of uncertainty in the Southeast. From SDPB, today is Friday, August 8th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we check in with Union County Emergency Management. It's been more than a year since a catastrophic flooding event destroyed homes in McCook Lake. We'll talk about the lessons learned, including the hard lesson about what would happen if a similar rain event occurred today. But first, the Watertown area has been blasted with extreme weather this summer, from heat to wind to tornadoes to heavy rain. We'll talk about what's still ahead this summer in the Northeast. Plus, it might be time to understand, I mean really understand, how your homeowner's insurance works. And it all starts with opening your mail. That is coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. It's been a rainy summer for the northeast corner of South Dakota. The area has seen frequent flooding, including just this week. Kelly Sayre is a warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Aberdeen. She joined me over the phone to discuss weather patterns pelting the area.
We started out our severe weather season actually kind of slow. As we got to the end of May and early June, and we actually had not issued as many warnings as we normally had, which is a good thing in any normal year. And then suddenly, by the end of June and throughout the month of July, we have just had day after day after day of storms and severe weather, and a wide range of different types of severe weather, from hail to tornadoes to flooding, really, really over across much of northeast South Dakota this so far up to this point.
Was it dry before in the early or the late spring, early summer? Were there drought conditions then?
It was. We came out of winter really dry. Most of the region was considered in drought as we came out of the winter months. And the spring, however, kind of rebounded as we got into the month of May. We saw precipitation return more to normal in terms of what we would normally see for the spring months. And then we hit the months of June and July and even early August here. And now we have tipped the scales completely, going from drought out of the winter to now an abundance of precipitation where areas are much above their normal precipitation for the summer.
What does it look like historically, especially when it comes to like how wet is this season compared to other years?
So if we just look from January through just today, and we compare up year to date, the amount of precip we have had, a good portion of northeast South Dakota has received anywhere from 4 to over 8 inches, what they normally would get in a year. So it's quite significant. Unfortunately, some areas have just gotten way too much, and we've seen flooding problems crop up. Now the ground is saturated, and anytime we get rain, that flooding just becomes more prevalent and more easy to happen.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about, you know, you said all kinds of different weather. We know tornado just this week, all severe weather. What's on the bingo card and what have you already checked off?
Well, we've had two very significant tornadoes at the end of June down in Doel County near the Clear Lake and Gary, South Dakota areas. We had several tornadoes that occurred. One of them was rated as an EF3, very high-end EF3 with estimated peak winds nearing 165 miles per hour. And then we had another significant tornado in July that was just northwest of Watertown. And that one was rated an EF2. That did some very significant damage to a farmstead as well. So very large, impressive tornadoes. We also have had large hail across the region. We have hail just recently, a little further west, but parts of central South Dakota where we had hail 3 inches in diameter, which in and of itself is very impressive. And then we also have had a few other hail reports from other storms across the region. And then, as we mentioned, flooding has been a big concern, really starting at the end of June. We had a couple of back-to-back just heavy rain events where we had storm systems that just kept moving over the same area, one after another, moving very slowly. And ever since then, with our saturated grounds and a few more events of slow-moving storms, we've just been dealing with the persistent flooding in northeast South Dakota. And then wind, too. We've had straight-line wind events that have caused damage to trees and structures. Just most recently, here on August 5th, we had some really high winds in the Watertown area that caused some pretty significant tree damage in the Lake Kampeska region.
Yeah, and some heat warnings and advisories as well. It's been hot.
Of course, we can't forget about heat.
Yeah.
And that's always the sneaky one. The number one, which people don't always think about, but the number one weather-related killer in the United States is heat.
Yeah.
And so don't let that sneak up on you either. Always take precautions when we have this high heat and humidity across the region.
So what's happening in the atmosphere that these storms are coming through? What are you watching or seeing that's, you know, either normal or abnormal?
Well, you know, a lot of it is just luck of the draw. This time of the year, the heat and humidity is certainly something that we're accustomed to. It's what happens in the summer in South Dakota. A lot of times that humidity is even exacerbated by the corn crop. Corn, we like to call it corn sweat. Corn releases moisture back into the atmosphere, and so it contributes to a little bit higher humidity. That moisture and the heat, those are the two ingredients we really need for the atmosphere to be one in which storms can develop very rapidly. So if we have that in place, then we watch for other things that are going to get that air rising, like fronts or other low-pressure systems that are going to work their way across the region. And if they all combine just perfectly, that's when we get the severe weather that happens. Again, we started out really slow,
right?
Not a lot of severe weather to start the season. But now that we are into through the month of July and August here, we've seen an above-normal amount of warnings that we have issued out of our office.
If you don't mind, let's talk a little bit about warning systems and how they work.
So the way it works, when we send out a warning from our office here at the National Weather Service in Aberdeen, and we cover a set amount of counties, there's a Weather Service office in Rapid City and one in Sioux Falls. And between the three of us, we cover the entire state of South Dakota. So depending on where you are in the state, that's the office that you'll be getting alerts from. But when our alerts go out, they activate the emergency alert system. And the emergency alert system is then our broadcast partners who are going to take that message and disseminate it out into the public. And so from us, it'll go to radio stations, which will deliver that message. It'll go to TV stations, which will scroll messages on TVs. It'll go to weather radio, which we maintain. And then it also goes out to the internet sources and third-party vendors, who a lot of them take that information and can redistribute it as well. And so the whole goal is to make sure that there are multiple redundant ways of getting this message across, because occasionally things do fail with technology, but we want to make sure that there's always a backup. There's always another way to get this information when severe weather is happening and people need to know so that they can protect themselves and protect their property.
That's Kelly Sayre, Warning Coordination Meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Aberdeen. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Last summer, homes at McCook Lake were gutted and roads destroyed by record-breaking flash flooding. We're going to look back on the response to the flood and the lessons learned from the tragedy. Jason Westcott is the Director of Emergency Management for Union County. He joined me from SDPB's studio on the campus of USD in Vermilion.
This area has been hit by several floods. Goes back as far as 2011. When we had a pretty dramatic flood in Dakota Dunes. Then there was another flood in 2014, another one in 2016, and another one in 2019, which kind of involved the Big Sioux and the North Sioux area. In 2019, they placed a levee across I-29 at Exit 4. What that comes from is a 1976 flood plan that was written up between the state, the county, the city, and also Sioux City area, in the hopes of if they place that levee It will stop flooding into North Sioux and down the interstate and into the edge of Dakota Dunes. When this flood started, we believed, looking at all the modeling and the data we were getting in, that we were going to get a flood much like 2019. What happened in 2019 is the water did make it to the interstate, but it never crossed the interstate line. So they did put the levee in as a precaution just in case the water did cross the interstate in the hopes that it would go into McCook Lake. We did the same thing in 2024 in June. We knew we had water coming. We were hoping it wasn't going to cross the interstate. And by the time the flood got to us, we had water levels that were unprecedented. Nobody planned on it. We didn't think we were going to get this much water. Watching upstream, you know, you look at Haywarden's damage. They had damage more than they normally have. Akron was the same way. They have damage that they normally don't get. But our damage was catastrophic and severe. I would constitute it to almost a tsunami hitting the Penrose area and North Shore. We had a very fast rising water with a very severe current in it, which was basically washing anything on the land out of its way and pushing it towards the lake. Mm-hmm. So we lost roughly 20 homes out there, total destruction of homes, 20 of them. And in total, there was about 30 homes damaged in that area. Not to mention the damage that we had all along the river throughout the county, from the north edge of the county south. We lost county bridges, we lost roadways. So it was quite a catastrophic hit in total for Union County to suffer this catastrophic flood.
Yeah. How long had you been in emergency management?
About 4.5 years.
Okay. So a couple questions. I want to know what you learned about your neighbors at that time. And then I also want to know what you learned about emergency management at that time that maybe you don't learn until you are in a crisis of this scale.
Well, as emergency managers, we're preparing constantly for crises. But I always say you can write plans all day long. You can write and just write and write plans. And, you know, we have flood plans. You have plans for tornadoes. You have plans for other things. And when the crisis actually hits, it never fits that plan.
Yeah.
Like this flood, it's not something you could ever prepare for. You know, you can prepare for the smaller floods and say, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And when you see houses start moving and washing out of the way, it really ups things, opens a lot of eyes. I had a group with me during the flood. It's our incident management assistance team, South Dakota IMAT team. I called them in instantaneously when we found out we were going to have flooding. That's a team of people that are specialized in different duties throughout the state. To help emergency managers. I'm also actually on that team. What we do as IMAT is we make sure everything's in order and that we're kind of following a certain path and we're following a track. And we're notating everything that's taking place is one of the big things. So that in the back end, when FEMA shows up, we're kind of set and ready to roll for those guys. We aid them out a lot in producing the paperwork that we're going to need to fix things. So early on, we did a lot of that. We also made sure we had the dive team down there before this incident took place because we didn't know how bad it was going to be, didn't know if we were going to have to go house to house and rescue people. We had no clue. It was a lot of unknowns. I can very vividly remember the morning of the flood. When we walked in early in the morning that morning and started prepping, the state hydrologist come to me and he goes, well, we've lost almost 16 hours overnight. The floodwaters are moving a lot faster than we thought, and it's going to be here a lot sooner. Mm. And that causes a lot of panic because we had plans, you know, well, we're going to do this throughout the day. We're going to do that this afternoon. We're going to do that this evening.
Right.
And that morning, instantly, everything pretty much got pushed. We need to go now and do now. So I've learned a lot from this experience. I won't say it was a great experience, but it was definitely a learning experience. You really pick up a lot of things when you're dealing with a crisis.
Yeah. What are some of the things you want to hear in a crisis from the people who come in the room and say, we've lost 16 hours?
It's very nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
I can tell you that. That morning there was a lot of panic because we didn't know, you know, the fullness of what we were going to get and what was going to land in our laps in a couple of hours. At that point, you know, we planned on building the interstate levee in the afternoon and into the evening. And at that point, we're like, we got to get this built now. If we don't, we're possibly going to have water going down the interstate and lose parts of North Sioux. Mm-hmm. After this flood hit, you know, I sat back and it was a lot of unknowns. You're hearing, okay, houses are gone, stuff's in the lake. You know, we got water here, we got water there. And at that point, I actually sat back and I said, okay, I want to know what would have happened if we wouldn't put this levee in place.
Yeah.
So we actually ran modeling to see what it would look like with the water flow we had of what would not happen if the levee did not get put in place. And we would have lost all of North Sioux and pretty much quite a big chunk of Dakota Dunes. And that's one thing I find solace in using this flood plan is that, you know, we saved the city of North Sioux. We saved quite a chunk of the dunes. But it also hurts my heart that we lost houses in this, you know. None of us planned on losing houses. So that was probably the biggest shock out of the whole incident.
Yeah. So the idea that you were sitting with all these options in front of you and you are, you know, in some kind of scenario where you're making a choice, well, we're going to sacrifice these houses to save this thing. That's not accurate representation of what happened.
Yeah,
but afterwards, you were able to say, okay, if we had made a different decision, let's look at how it would have played out.
Yep.
And that's what you discovered after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, the plan was never to sacrifice anybody's home.
Yeah.
We were hoping we'd have a much smaller, you know, flood and the water would go over the interstate and flow into the lake. And that is not what we got. You know, this situation was nothing that any of us expected and could have judged was going to happen.
Yeah.
And it happened very fast. I mean, in a matter of hours. So it's no different than any other natural disaster. You know, it's kind of like I said, you can plan and plan and plan, and then the disaster hits and you don't get what you think you're going to get. So
what did you learn about your neighbors and how they responded in a crisis?
Well, I can tell you Iowa responds to incidents a little bit differently than South Dakota does. And it causes a lot of confusion. South Dakota is now working on this. We've never had it before, but they're trying to. Iowa has actual flood funds at the state level. What that allows Iowa to do is if somebody has a flood like they had over on the Iowa side, for the state to divvy into funds right away and kind of start handing money out to people before FEMA even gets there. And it caused a lot of confusion on our side of the border because, you know, we're neighborly. People talk back and forth. It's not like there's a giant wall in between Iowa and South Dakota. And early on, we start hearing, oh, well, people are getting FEMA money in Iowa right away. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that can't quite be possible. FEMA's not even here yet. Iowa doesn't have FEMA. We don't have FEMA. So we kind of started doing a lot of digging, trying to figure out what are people talking about? Where's this money coming from that people in Iowa are getting? And we found out pretty fast, well, Iowa's got flood funds, and they're divvying out that money in small amounts to people to just make them comfortable till FEMA arrives and people can start getting FEMA payments. On the South Dakota border side, we don't have any of that at state level. So there is no flood funds, you know, that the governor can jump into and say, okay, hey, here, we're going to give the citizens some money to make them a little bit more comfortable until FEMA shows up. So that was kind of a big learning curve there on what was going on the other side of the border and why people were already getting money and we weren't. So,
yeah. All right. So then what happens next? FEMA comes and a year later, have people been made whole? Are there big gaps in, like, from a big picture standpoint, what's recovery like?
So the FEMA process is pretty laborious and drawn out, and the general public doesn't see a lot of this. But South Dakota, what we do is we use a system called Crisis Track. And the second we found out FEMA's coming, we're going to do a declaration. The governor is signing the declaration. We're rolling on that. We go into a program called Crisis Track. We put out a web link, and we tell everybody, okay, anybody that's been devastated or injured by this catastrophe, you need to get on this web link and sign up. What that program then does is it starts gathering data for me and the state to look at to know what levels we're at and what type of losses we have and where they're at. And then the process plays out with FEMA. The governor signs the declaration. It gets sent up to the president's office, and then he signs it, and it moves on to FEMA. And they make a decision on, okay, this is what we need. This is what we're going to take to that area, and this is what we're looking at. Crisis Track really helped us out in that aspect because it saved FEMA a lot of work. We were able to hand Crisis Track all of our data and say, here, look at these areas, go here, and this is these are the people that need help. So it kind of sped things up kind of from an aspect of them not having to go out and do what we call ground pounding, go house to house, door to door, knock on every house door and say, hey, what kind of damage do you have? So that did speed things up. As far as FEMA, I will say they did a great job, but I do know, you know, FEMA leaves a lot of holes. We had very few people that had flood insurance during this flood. And when FEMA walks in and they say, well, here's $45,000. That's our max payout. And you have a $338,000 house that's, you know, 80% destroyed. It leaves a big hole. The FEMA payments did come out pretty fast, but there's still a lot of people in that hole of, you know, yeah, I got my FEMA money. I've already spent it. And now where do I go? My home is still half destroyed.
So they didn't have flood insurance because it's not in a floodplain, right?
Yes,
right.
Yes.
I think that needs to be clear for people who don't live in the area. This is not a floodplain. It flooded because of the action that was taken.
Yeah, and it used to be in a floodplain. Years ago, it was in a floodplain.
Okay.
And what happened is somewhere along the way, that got moved out of a floodplain by FEMA. Mm-hmm. And when you're no longer in a floodplain, you have a choice. You can either keep your flood insurance or you can drop it. Well, a lot of people at that point, you know, they're like, well, we're no longer in this floodplain. I don't want to bear the extra expense of this flood insurance, so we're going to drop our flood insurance.
Has that 1976 plan updated then? What's the process there?
So it is a big, long, drawn-out process. We have already gone to the Army Corps. What we're waiting for with the Army Corps currently is to get a river study done of the Big Sioux. And what that'll do is they'll go from the beginning of our Big Sioux in our county all the way down to the south end. They'll totally study it, and then they'll give us a plan, basically. They'll give us ideas. They're going to say, hey, maybe look at doing this to cause it not to flood again, or look at doing that to cause it not to flood again. Once we get all that data back from that study, that'll allow us to also go into that 1976 plan and say, okay, we maybe need to modify this or we need to change that. So the problem with the 1976 plan and the general public doesn't understand this is you have to use that. It was written up by the Corps. It was written up by FEMA, the city, the county, the state. And if we would have not utilized that during this flood, we probably would have not got the FEMA payments we got because FEMA would have been able to come in and say, well, you didn't use our plan. You have more damage than you should have, and now we're either not going to pay you or we're going to pay less.
Mm. How long does that take? Did you say that? About how long a river study like that would take?
Well, the Corps runs a year behind the year. It's kind of hard. We've already asked for the study to be done. We're hoping by the end of 2026, 2027, we'll have it done. But with the federal government and things moving around and money moving around like it is in the federal government right now, we're kind of unsure on a timeline. We have not been given an exact date for that.
Yeah. So these are not 100-year events anymore.
No,
this could
not
happen, not tomorrow because we know the forecast, but you know, this could happen at any given time.
You are correct. I mean, all it took was roughly 17 inches of rain north of Union County, and we had a 1,000-year flood. So it could happen at any time. We have a rain system stall out somewhere and we have more flooding.
Yeah. So the plan would be the same if it happened again now.
Yeah. At this time, it would be exactly the same. I hate to say that, but yes, it would be the same.
Would you do anything differently this time, knowing that now that you've been? Okay, let me be clear about this question. There are certain things that you can't do differently. You've made clear that you're bound to execute a plan that's legally tied to FEMA funding? Mm-hmm. Or are there things that you learned from the first time that if it happened again, you would have experience with and they might go more smoothly, even if the outcome was also a catastrophe?
Yeah. I mean, I hate to say it, you know, we know the plan is flawed. We know the plan needs to be changed. And it's kind of like you said, we're kind of stuck with it right now until we can get the Corps in here and get a river study done and make modifications to said plan. You know, we talk about this all the time, and Union County is on a 4 to 5 year record of floods. Either it's a 50-year flood, a 100-year flood, 150, 500,000. And our weather patterns are changing. The National Weather Service has been telling us this for years, you know, that Tornado Alley is moving north and our weather patterns are shifting and we're going to start seeing different weather. We've definitely seen that this summer with the derechos, the rain patterns. We're just getting a lot more rain and different weather patterns. So, I mean, the thing I hope is that our public is learning to be more weather aware, to watch the weather, and to kind of heed what the National Weather Service is saying. Mm-hmm. A lot of people said, you know, well, there wasn't enough warning, there wasn't enough advance notice. The National Weather Service put out 43 watches and warnings before this flood. And I think lots of times the general public, they see that and they're just like, oh, it's a flood watch, that's not a big deal. Oh, it's a flood warning, that's not a big deal. Well, that's when it gets to a warning standpoint, that means that that is going to happen. It's no longer a watch. That's National Weather Service saying the water's coming up, it's going to flood. So, you know, we always tell the public, you know, you need to be weather aware, you need to watch, you need to have apps on your phone, get a weather radio, get on the internet, check your local weather. We've also been pushing a lot. The Corps now has a new system where you can get alerts on your phone for the river. And we've been pushing people, you know, hey, there's this app. You can put your local area rivers in there, and it will actually alert your phone when it's going to come up or when it's getting to flood stage.
That's Jason Westcott. He's the Director of Emergency Management for Union County. He was talking there about the catastrophic June 2024 flooding in the region. The app that he mentioned is online. Search for USGS Water Alert in your browser to sign up for push notifications. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A rising tide raises all ships, and it might also raise insurance rates, even in landlocked states. South Dakotans are not exempt from the impacts of human-caused climate change. We're seeing more frequent and more severe extreme weather events. So if you have been casual about your homeowner's insurance, now might be the time to understand your policy, make sure it is up to date, and make sure you understand how to use it to protect your home and your family's financial future. Derek Washington and Scott Tyler are insurance agents with Wilcoxon Insurance in Sioux Falls. They join me in the Kirby Family Studio. We'll begin here with the basics of flooding and flood insurance.
Typically speaking, we don't run into flood insurance unless somebody is in a floodplain. FEMA designates those floodplains based on the base flood elevation level of each community.
Okay.
If you're in a floodplain, usually your mortgage lender, whoever that might be, Fannie Freddie, Wells Fargo, will require you to carry flood insurance. And that's most of the calls we get, is somebody buying a new property that's in a flood zone.
Yeah, and then they're required to have it.
Yep.
What are some of the questions you should be asking, Scott, about flood insurance if you're concerned about it?
Like Derek had referenced, you don't necessarily need it. Well, you know, sometimes you can, obviously, that we've seen the last few years, but you're usually not going to even know if you are in a flood zone or not unless you're going to, you know, going through the home buying process or refinance process, and you know your mortgage lender might say, you know, hey, we need flood insurance on this property. There is a good tool out there that if you just go to Google and you just type in FEMA flood map, you can type in your address and it'll show you some of the overlays. You know, it'll throw a pin down kind of on your address and it'll show some overlays where you can also see if you are in a flood map or in a flood zone, and in particular what flood zone you are in. For instance, X is a big one that's kind of right borderline flood zone. And then AE is generally the most common one for what who's going to need flood insurance and all that type of stuff on their on their properties.
But Derek, just because I'm not in a flood zone doesn't mean my house isn't going to flood in a severe rain event. What kind of insurance do I need if it just rains like crazy and water comes through my basement?
Yeah. So typical homeowner's insurance will not cover any water from the outside in, which we call flood. It's a common misconception. If you get water, some people say my basement flooded.
Right.
If it's coming up through a sump pump, through foundation, that's not going to be covered by flood insurance. It has to be water from the outside in. How they determine a flood is if it's 2 square miles that are normally dry become partially or fully inundated with water, that would determine a flood. Or if 2 properties, one being your property, becomes flooded, they declare that a flood. So if you're the only one in your neighborhood that gets water from the outside in, there would be no coverage under flood insurance.
Okay. What does cover it if water comes in through my foundation in a severe rain event?
So water through the foundation is never going to be covered by homeowner's insurance, which...
I'm making a face at you.
Yes, that we get
you,
that
face. You've gotten that face a lot.
Yes, we get that face a lot. So insurance companies don't like covering what they can't see. So a crack in the foundation... crack in the foundation floors, anything like that, joists between the floors usually aren't covered by homeowners insurance.
Okay.
Right. A lot of that's chalked up to earth movement is a lot of what they say too. They can't, you know, insurance companies like to insure things and, you know, rightfully so that they can potentially prevent or be able to underwrite for, right? So they know the, you know, odds of XYZ storm coming through or hail or wind or the occurrence and the severity and how often that happens, right? They don't necessarily know what the foundation looks like, you know, behind in every home out there, depending on age. If that was something that you did want covered or anything like that and that became industry standard, you would see premiums obviously increase, you know, exponentially as well. When you do get water in your basement, what is covered, though, is you have to have the water sewer rider, of course. But if it does back up through a sump hole or if it does come through a drain in the house and you have water sewer backup coverage on there, then that is a, would be a covered loss for you there. So,
okay. What if a window breaks or it comes through a window seam?
Not covered by your homeowner's insurance.
Right. These are good things to know.
We get that, especially if a egress window hole isn't covered. Mm-hmm. And we've seen window wells fill up with water, and then suddenly the window gives way. So there is a sudden burst of water from the outside in to your home. Not going to be covered by your homeowner's insurance. In certain situations, it's not happening to your neighbors or anybody else in the area, so it wouldn't even be covered by flood insurance if you did carry flood insurance.
So that's just going to be on you as a homeowner no matter what.
Correct.
Right.
There are some instances where a window breaking would be covered, but that generally chalks up to what causes the window to break and different things like that. Yeah. So
what are some of the trends that you're seeing in homeowners insurance right now nationwide? You know, are there events that are happening nationwide that are affecting rates, for example, in South Dakota? Are there trends in South Dakota that you're seeing?
Yeah, for instance, what we've been seeing here over the last couple of years, especially locally, you know, we had the derecho and the hailstorms in 2022. Obviously, throughout the last few years, building materials and the cost of homes have, you know, increased exponentially as well. The insurance company has to keep up with that cost, right? You know, so they're insuring your property for X value from a replacement cost standpoint at, you know, certain premium amount. So on the back end of things, all the numbers have to check out. So if that replacement cost increases by 15-20% due to labor and materials, your homeowner's insurance, just mathematically speaking, on the back end of things, has to take that same rate increase at a minimum. As far as trends as well, kind of back along the weather side of things, 1% wind hail deductibles are becoming industry standard anymore. Back in 2019, 2020, and even earlier, you know, you used to have $500 wind hail deductibles, $1,000 wind hail deductibles. Now it's becoming 1% just because the frequency of these storms is, you know, obviously it seems like they're becoming more frequent or have been more frequent and a little bit more severe. we've seen a lot of wind hail deductibles go up to that 1%. And you might ask, what is 1%? That is 1% of the insured value of your house. So if your house is insured for $300,000, or, you know, say your house is insured for $500,000, your wind hail deductible is now $5,000 instead of, you know, maybe the $1,000 that it used to be a few years ago.
And so if you bought your house 10 years ago, and, you know, I bought my house 20 some years ago for $75,000, I could be surprised if all of a sudden I have a hail event and I go to my insurer and say, I'm expecting a certain deductible. Certainly not going to, the value of replacing my house is not going to be $75,000. So a whole, I guess my point is a whole lot has changed since I bought the house.
Correct.
And so what I'm hearing from you is I should be in conversation with my agent. When he calls me every year and says, I'd like to talk to you, I should probably return that call, Derek.
For sure.
I
mean,
I should really be talking to my agent to find out what I have and what I don't have. So I'm not surprised.
And
open your mail.
I would definitely suggest if you're getting any letters, anything like that from your insurance company, it's going to pertain specific important information. That's going to be if the carrier has changed those deductibles. And a lot of carriers aren't grandfathering in to the $1,000 deductible. They're making company-wide changes where if your deductibles change, they're going to send out communications on that. They're required by law to communicate that to you.
Okay.
So we have had a lot of carriers go to that 1% deductible, and people have been surprised on the back end when a claim does come.
Yeah, yeah. How often should you be checking in and monitoring? I mean, obviously open your mail, which, you know, we say that like it's silly. I just went through 3 months of mail this weekend, because we're busy and we're overwhelmed by stuff.
Yeah.
And so you can be forgiven for not knowing things, but here is your PSA.
So
check out
you'll get an annual renewal. You know, you generally,
a lot
that
of
mail,
fine print.
Generally that mail comes out 45-30 days in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any drastic changes, a lot of times like the carriers that we work with, they'll send out stuff, you know, it's going to be page one. You know, they're going to make it easily readable, all that type of stuff.
Okay.
So, I mean, just keep an eye on your insurance policies year to year. Homeowners insurance is something that is easy to kind of set and forget just because most people escrow their homeowners insurance.
Right.
And if you're signed up for maybe even paperless policy delivery or paperless documents, you know, you might get an email. You don't open your email. You don't go into your online account, all that type of stuff too. So it's just good to, you know, be aware of that type of stuff. Another change that we're seeing that could affect Sioux Falls quite substantially is a lot of carriers are going to actual cash value on roofs after age 10 or after age 15 of the shingle. The reason I say that could, if there's this, okay, so say you have a, you know, got a new roof in 2018, right? And you have replacement costs on your roof and you suffer a loss and you have replacement cost. The cost of a new roof to replace your roof is going to get paid for by the insurance company in full minus your deductible.
Mm-hmm.
Actual cash value, what that does is it takes into account depreciation. Just like, you know, like an auto, like if you were to get into a car accident, you know, instead of getting $35,000, what you paid for the vehicle 3-4 years ago, you know, obviously that depreciates. Same thing with shingles. So you'll get replacement costs for 10 years on your shingles, or depending on the carrier, up to 15. But as soon as your 16 hits, they're going to depreciate your roof 11 years or 15, 16 years of depreciation there.
So in other words, don't wait to get your shingles replaced until it's a hail event and you're expecting your insurance company to cover the whole thing.
Yeah.
Home maintenance needs to happen, to be very basic. You need to be saving for regular home maintenance, because it, not just, hey, there was a damage and now my insurance company will take care of it for me.
Sure.
You might find out that your shingles were old and needed to be replaced anyway.
Correct.
I understand what you're saying.
Biggest rating factors in our world when it comes to property is how old is the roof? Because the insurance company knows if a roof is 17 years old and we do get even a minor hailstorm, they're more likely to file a claim and have damage.
Okay.
Compared to shingles are made to hold up to hail for
right.
the most part. So if you have a 3-year-old roof, usually your insurance premiums are going to be a little lower because the insurance company realizes, like, yes, we can get a hailstorm, but those shingles should be able to hold up to whatever minimal hail there is.
Yeah, After the last storm, I found a couple shingles in my backyard. I don't know if they're mine or not. So then I'm like, so now what do I do? If I don't know those shingles are mine. In other words, there's been a storm. How do you check to make sure that everything is okay? I need to get on the roof. Or do I need to call my agent?
I would definitely... Depending on how comfortable you are.
I'm not getting on the roof, Derek, to be clear. Somebody else will be getting on the roof for me.
I will never tell any of my clients to get on their own roof. Yeah, if someone feels comfortable enough to get on their own roof and they do it themselves, more power to you. But there is a lot of roofing companies that will be able to check if you have damage and if that damage is substantial. Mm-hmm. What I always like to say is... use a local roofing company. There are a lot of roofing companies that if a hailstorm comes through, they'll come into town, fix a roof, never be seen again. I always like to push people towards a local company that's been here or is going to be here still. If there's any ever situation with your shingles, you know they're a call away. They're going to answer and be able to come visit you again.
Yeah. Are you seeing people who are getting dropped? We're hearing that a lot. Insurance companies are pulling out of entire regions because of the changing weather patterns or climate change or how that region is. What are you seeing happening for real, and what is fear-mongering and panic?
I would say along those lines, we can kind of go back to 2022, and we were talking about this a little bit before, but insurance companies the last couple of years have gone through a lot of changes, and they had to, you know, kind of tighten up to figure out what they wanted to do or how they wanted to, you know, one, stay in business. Because just referencing 2022, there were a couple of companies that we worked with. And actually that year, every homeowner's insurance carrier in the state darn near took a pretty substantial loss. You know, one of our carriers had $10 million in homeowner's insurance premiums in the state, and they paid out over $30 million in losses that year. You know, obviously a $20 million loss can't run a company losing that much money for very long. So we've seen some things like that. And as far as getting dropped, back to insurance carriers kind of tightening up, there has been a little bit with, hey, if you've had one non-weather claim here or there, you know, we're going to drop you. Just because they have looked at, you know, it's more of an occurrence type of situation than a severity. Like they're generally going to stick with someone if it's like a, hey, weather happens. But as soon as, you know, there's a couple different, you know, claims that happen, you know, with said individual or in an account, that's when they do want to move off of it. Because at the end of the day, you got to think that you as a client are an investment to this insurance company, right? Just like, you know, we invest in different things like stock market, all that type of stuff. What are the odds of me making money on my investment? The insurance companies have to think of it the same way too, you know, because that's how they have to operate. That's how they can stay in business, is they have to make money off of people buying insurance policies at the end of the day. So the odds of client XYZ, you know, John Doe, making them pay out, you know, a hefty amount of money, you know.
And I don't think when I was a new homeowner, anybody ever explained to me, the way I thought about it was, I'm paying you money so that if something happens, I don't have to pay for that big thing. That's why insurance, and I've given you a lot of money now because I'm paying you. I've never used it. So when something did happen, I wanted to use it. And I didn't quite understand because nobody had told me that sometimes you don't file a claim if something happens, you know, so you have to be cautious about what. Yeah. So when would you file a claim and when would you not? How are you making that decision, Derek? Yeah.
I always say insurance is used in catastrophe, major events. Me personally, if I'm looking at a $5,000 bill because some shingles blew off and I have a, say, $3,500 deductible, am I going to profit hey, I'll have $1,500 to pay for said claim? Me personally, I'm probably not filing that claim. And we have these conversations every day with clients about if it's going to make sense to file this claim or not.
Okay.
And part of that is where you're at financially also.
Right.
There is some people that are going to say, no, I'll just pay for that $1,500 out of my pocket. And there's some people that don't have that $1,500. So it is individually based on if I'm going to say file that claim or not file that claim.
Is this just going to get more and more and more expensive? with increasing weather, extreme weather?
A little bit. I'd say a lot of our carriers kind of have it figured out for now. How they want to do things, like we had talked about, a lot of the wind hail deductible stuff. This last windstorm that came through, we have already seen a lot more of our conversations where people just saying, oh, you know, I don't have that much damage. I'll just do this myself instead of turning in the claim, which is good because, you know, one, that puts a little bit more on the homeowner, yes, but at the end of the day, it also saves the collective in insurance premiums. You know, that's when things start, you know, kind of getting up there is when you have a lot of just a lot of claims, $2,000 here, $1,000 here, $2,000 here, you know, type of deal. So
on that, I'd also say most insurance companies are going to adjust your home value year over year. Okay. They know that it's going to cost more to insure your home. Like you mentioned earlier, it's going to cost more to replace your home today than it did in 2010.
Right.
So each year, if you pay attention to your insurance, you're going to see your coverage A, which would be your dwelling coverage, increase. Most of those are increasing by, we see $10,000 to $15,000 increases every year. It's just because the value to replace that home increases also.
Yeah.
And with that increase, your premiums do increase also. So when we look at a standard 10% increase year over year in your homeowner's insurance premium, it's fairly common for us.
And to kind of piggyback off of some of that too, we had been talking about claims and insurance premiums increasing. Homeowners claims do stay on your history for 5 years, no matter what insurance carrier it is with. So if you have a hail claim from 2 years ago, that's going to be on your, essentially your account underneath your name for 5 years, no matter if you're quoting with the same company or many different companies, they're all going to know that you had a hail claim, you know, 2-3 years ago, or a theft claim, or a fire, or a fire and a water and a hail. You know, that's when premiums really start getting up there, is when you have, you know, 2-3 claims in a 5 year period.
Yeah, but I can't stop the hail.
Yeah, exactly. And insurance carriers, they rate a lot of that type of stuff differently on the back end. They're not going to hit you over the hand as much with like a hail or a wind claim as they would, you know, something, a claim that's deemed a little bit more, you know, personally controllable, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember getting like the shingles done on our roof, and the roofers were done. And I said, that's great. The 20 year shingles or whatever. I said, it's going to be 20 years before I see you again. He said, or tomorrow. And I was like, oh yeah, you know, that's a good thing to remember. Yeah. But then to that point, would I get covered to 2 months in a row if I had catastrophic damage on your house?
If there is, we saw it in 2022, actually, where there was two windstorms close to each other, where someone would file a claim, not have the work completed yet because they couldn't get a roofer out, and then new damage would come.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that is going to be two separate occurrences, so it would be two separate claims, which would be two deductibles paid also.
Two agents from Wilcoxon Insurance, Derek Washington and Scott Tyler, with a call to action on understanding your homeowner's insurance. And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and R. Youngeman. I'm Lori Walsh from all of us here at SDPB. Thank you for listening.